Hello, I'm Vicky Butler Henderson, and this is the latest Historics Auctioneers podcast. In this issue, we will be telling you 10 ways on how to make money from classic cars and which are the best optional extras to tick to increase value in a car. Oh, I can't wait.
Buying or selling a classic car? Head to historics.co.uk or click below for a free valuation.
So here we are then with the latest Historics Auction. I am joined as ever by auction engineer. Ooh, engineer. Auction engineer.
What a qualification. Look at that.
Whatever you are, you're brilliant. Really, Matthew Priddy.
Is it better than expert? Probably not.
I don't know. And YouTuber expert and anything else you'd quite like to give yourself a title to, Tom Exton.
Yeah, that'll do. Hello, everyone.
Hello. Hi. So if you would like to know more about the podcast and understand a bit more about Historics, where can they go for info, Tom?
You can head over to Instagram if you are an Instagrammer. You can also, if you're watching this on YouTube, you're well aware of the YouTube channel. And you can also follow the podcast on all usual streaming platforms.
Absolutely.
Can you not?
Absolutely.
And of course, Historics has got a website and you'll see all the cars on there as well. All the catalogue is very well documented on there with all the details and all the cars.
Yeah, we are actually just ahead of the latest auction at Mercedes-Benz World at Brooklands in Surrey. So we've got all the lovely cars around us. But it's almost Christmas.
Yes.
And if you can think about me as like the Christmas fairy. The Christmas fairy, I take the lot. Any decoration, I'll take it. Now, in this podcast, we will also be discussing Formula One. And this is also a nod to Las Vegas because the Las Vegas race has just occurred. And one of us has been. I've got a special drawing game for you that you can also try at home.
Oh, no.
Yes.
Not
and
again.
Basically, anything else that we get sidetracked into, we will be talking about. So, the money shot. Let's get on with the 10 ways of how you can make money from classic cars. So, I suggest number one, buy one.
It's probably a good place to start, isn't it? You probably need one to make money on it in the first place. Let's cover first base would be buying one well, holding on to it and then selling it for a profit. Now, you've had a bit of experience with that successfully, unsuccessfully. Probably most of us have, to be honest, haven't we? But if you buy a car on the up, you can hold on to it and then you can pick the right time to sell when it's at maximum value. That would be the one way in which we'd all love to own and sell and make money on a classic car. The tricky part is you've got to know when it's going up before it goes up and you've got to know when it's at its peak. And we've had this conversation about SLRs, SLSs before, haven't we? If you bought one nice and cheap, fantastic. You've got stage one done. How long do you hold on for it?
I know.
And in that meantime, could that money have done else thing? So it's tricky. Although you get it right, then you're really going to make a lot of money on a car. You know, we could be talking about cars tripling value. But again, knowing that isn't easy. And if it was that easy, and I do this every single day, do you think I'd be sat here with these two?
Oh, you
I was about
rude.
To say the same thing. As much as I love you both.
So yeah, that's probably number one.
What about your experiences of buying and selling at peak and trough market times?
I think it differs depending on whether or not you're buying a true classic that's going to need restoration and you know your 60s, 70s and even 80s stuff, the stuff that rusts and needs redoing, or you're buying kind of modern classic stuff, which I've started doing recently. So your kind of modern, last of the best sort of collectibles, they're slightly easier because there's no restoration or anything involved. And a lot of those did dip. Yeah. Following the financial crisis and stuff, there's a lot of low volume cars from sort of 2008 or so that they didn't make that many of. So it's actually relatively easy and they're quite low maintenance. But the classic stuff, the one thing I've learned is buy one that's ideally already been restored, because the money that you spend restoring a car, you often don't see back when you sell. So a lot of the cars that come through Historics, they've had full nut and bolt restorations and the previous owner spent 150 grand on them, but actually you can pick the car up for less than 100.
Yeah.
So you there's so much intrinsic value in the restoration that, and that's one thing that I probably wouldn't do again. I would buy something that's been documented and restored.
Picking the car comes down to a lot of factors, and we've all spoken about this quite a few times. You know, there's trends in age groups and when people are starting to spend money. So you can say, okay, let's say the 80s might be a good time to buy a car because at that point people are starting to reflect on what they couldn't have and they want to put money into.
Yep.
You're quite right trying to find cars built in smaller numbers because they may well have a little bit more of a jump when the prices go. You always want that car that goes first. You don't want the car that's on the coattails.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it does bring us back to that mileage rubbish with more modern cars. Everyone's obsessed with low mileage cars. But I think if you can find something that's truly one of three, one of five, then you've got a better chance of the values increasing over time. But picking cars is difficult. And you're quite right. Restoration is for love, I think.
Yeah, it's
not necessarily for, unless you do it at the right time again and you're lucky that you picked up the car for nothing and restored it whilst the prices were jumping through the roof. That's really difficult.
That's
to pitch.
Really, really tricky. Or if you've got a YouTube channel and you can scrounge deals off people, restoring them. Yeah, I was going to say something else, but I completely forgot. Jetlag's got me. We'll get on to that.
Ooh, giving the game away.
Restoring-wise, I do know of a few people that have done very well out of restoring a car and selling it, but it's traditionally the restorer, as in the company helping you do it, that makes the profit from that.
Yeah.
So you're better off creating a restoration business and restoring for people.
Brilliant.
Or working as working in the industry in that respect. You get to see the cars and you get to make money, but it's difficult, I think.
It's incredibly cash intensive as well. You know, by the time you bought the car and then you put all the money into restoring it as well, there's a lot of cash tied up. And obviously you can't really fund the restoration. Yeah. You can do finance on the asset in the first place, but to finance a restoration, it's often
grand. Because if you've got minimum. Time in that if you're timing that and you're paying fees for that amount of money, you've also got to make the profit trump that amount of interest. Plus, of course, if you were to take that lump of money, put it somewhere else, you've also got to trump that. So it's got to be a decent turn. You know, making a couple of thousand has got to be done very quickly, otherwise it's not necessarily worth it. But if you can make hundreds of thousands of pounds on a car because you picked the right sports car, supercar at the right possible time. And I know I've always banged on, from a year ago, we said about the SLR, that's the kind of car we all thought is a potential to literally go from 500 to a million kind of thing. That sort of car is where you.
It's taken
really
longer than I thought it would. The other thing, though, as well, that worth bearing in mind is, it's tax free.
There's the big.
Unless
trump.
You're doing on single seater race cars, your gain on these things is tax free. So that is an incentive to a lot of people.
Why single seater racing cars?
Non road cars, I think, are subject to capital gains. Wow. But your normal road cars, there's no capital gains on it yet. Okay. I think they will change that because some people are making bonkers money.
I think they'll probably put that down to a year, a classics scenario again, whereby once it's over 20, 30 years, that tax classification would remain. But more modern cars, we might find that disappear because of the more recent ability of people flipping cars from new, which we've seen lots of course, and YouTube perfect for that. But, we see lots of.
I've obviously never done such a thing, but and if I did, they would go through a company, so I'd have to pay tax on the profit. But Joe blogs on the street.
Could buy himself a brand new GT3, get early on the list, pop it straight out for £20,000 profit.
Well, that's another way to make money.
There is, that was massively prevalent, especially through COVID, of course.
Yeah.
Because cars were slower to build and lists were incredibly difficult to get on and people are impatient.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Especially at the higher level. You've got the money, you get very impatient, you just want to buy it now. Well, okay, pay £20,000 over the list price and that fella's selling the car that he bought 3 months ago. The manufacturer's got a bit of the ump with it and some adopted it and accepted it, others didn't. But equally, if you got on that list early and you were all about the money and not the car, there are significant sums that people could make out of it. That the early Range Rover was one, 911 GT3s was one, a lot of cars jumping in, jumping out of.
Your whole garage.
Sorry, Tom.
New house came from somewhere.
What about a famous owner? How does that affect the
provenance?
Can you make money on that?
So,
the Queen.
Yes. So Queen, that's quite top of at the moment. But if you can find that provenance, then you've naturally got that uptake. Mm-hmm.
So you need factual evidence.
So recently we sold one at Windsor. We sold a car that we were almost certain, 99.9% certain. If you check on the YouTube channel, there's a whole video about it. And we went through all of the bits that the vendor and us had pulled together from all the provenance, and it really did secure the fact that this is almost certainly, but it missed a photo or a video, which just we couldn't find. We even put out please come to us. So the chap bought it for probably four times its value on that potential. £40,000 I think it was for a Range Rover worth best part £10,000 if it didn't have the provenance. So we already had an uplift. So the first buyer bought it for nothing, found a load of provenance, he's made four times that amount of money. The guy who purchased it the second time from us, nice chap, he took a big risk because if it had come to service, it wasn't that car. He's back down to 10 again.
Mm.
But luckily, from his part of view, because of all that provenance and the auction and all the videos went live, the newspapers picked up on it shortly after it sold, someone picks up the phone. I've got a video with her in that car. Cha-ching, perfect. So the chap's bought a £40,000 Range Rover, which is now worth over £100,000. So
he's no way, really.
Great story.
So you've got this linear thing, but it's about therefore finding that. Now, owner number two was probably more luckier, whereas owner number one had a bit of luck, but also did an awful lot of research to get there. But equally, it just comes in those little bits of provenance trickling along. If you're buying a car with provenance, it's already got provenance. And if you buy a car, let's say you buy Sir Elton John's car, I'm going to pick a name out. If you're buying it off of Sir Elton John and you're changing that V5 document from him to you, straight away that value starts to diminish further and further away from that person, unless like art, you know, the artist dies or something comes to light. So the first person to really sell that car with its provenance is where the real value is. But again, it's unearthing it.
Yeah, totally. What about cars that are character cars or used in films or as seen on Fifth Gear?
There's also a bit of a nod to our illustrious owner with his cars.
Indeed, our illustrious owner, Mark.
Our overlord.
He has many Batmobiles and...
Yeah, there's no reason why you can't own cars and rent them out for film work. Film work's quite prevalent, actually. It's quite a lot of film work that goes on. So if you've got something that's of use to films, I would say they're as good as they are with everything. You are giving a car to a film company for the whole day. It's a bit spooky. And Mark has lots of cars that he literally creates for films, sort of Batmobiles and all sorts of things like that, which he makes a
naughty
business
car.
From. Yeah. Yep. And I know a lot of clients who have like a collection of cars who live in picturesque places who will rent them for the day.
Yeah.
A bit like modern supercar companies. And you can do that. I think I wouldn't have my pride and joy to do that.
Static, though. I think you still peel like grand a day just having your car static somewhere. You can drive it there and then just sort of leave it there for the day. Take the keys with you so you can't move it around.
The DB5 that Mark used to have used to do a fair bit of wedding work. That was a drive up a driveway. And then a couple of his cars you pay to be in a shopping centre or something for people to come and take pictures with.
Yeah, great.
That's good business. Yeah. Very good business.
Well, as chauffeur weddings, that could be another opportunity.
Well, the wedding industry and chauffeur industry had a problem with tax a number of years ago, which really pulled that in. Because obviously a lot of Rolls-Royce Silver Clouds, even things like the modern Phantoms would have been perfect for that, especially with proms. I mean, where did that come from?
Well,
I mean, that didn't exist and now suddenly everyone goes to proms. So you can rent them out for things like that. Again, if it's something that's not too precious, I think that's a good way of making money and also a good way of keeping a classic car on the road.
Yeah. Yeah.
Although a lot of the old wedding cars, the old Rolls-Royce wedding cars we used to have, used to be mechanically very sound, look good from a distance, but were naturally, it's like a taxi, isn't it? People trawling out and getting in and get out. So,
what about using the car as a billboard? Because I know that Historics has got a taxi with Historics written over it, which is always quite eye-catching.
Yeah, poor thing gets put everywhere on the roundabouts and it's just marauded around the place. Yeah,
having it as a billboard for your company.
Well, we had a lot of Citroën A-vans and so that, you know, you can convert them.
Yes.
So we've had lots of the Citroën A-vans or the old Morris vans and all converted to either coffee shops or they can be sign written for companies, sometimes just parked out front of their shops.
We've also had a big double-decker bus as well that was a sort of playpen and a disco bus.
Yeah, that was incredible.
Yeah,
that,
exactly.
Yeah.
So that is instantly a business unless you just fancy that.
Problem is you're parking
somewhere. Yes.
Yeah, imagine turning up at night.
Yeah, exactly.
And obviously YouTube is a business as well. If you buy a car and you make nothing but content with it and you don't do any personal use with the car and you literally document it all and then you get rid of it at the end. Then
this is a really good track, actually, isn't it? Because a moment ago I was working with one of the engineers downstairs and all he was doing was replacing a battery.
Mm.
And he's looking on YouTube. And you can be really informative. But it comes back to the restoration. You can restore a car. If you videoed that entire restoration process, you can bet your life there's a lot of people who would love to see how you did it.
Yeah,
and that would pay a fair way.
I was driving a Citroën 2CV a couple of years ago, and I was being filmed for it. But I had I was away from the film crew, and I didn't have any sort of contact with them.
Yep.
And I needed to get the car into reverse, and it got a dodgy clutch anyway because of just magic trickery that was going on. But I YouTubed where on earth was reverse in the Citroën 2CV.
There we go.
And
we don't need to know anything anymore. We can just go on YouTube and Google.
You could probably build a house on YouTube. You probably could.
Yeah.
But definitely a way of doing this.
You could. I mean, don't go on my channel. There's no useful advice on there. Let alone building.
So what would be your best bet then to make money? Which would you choose?
do you know what? I'd come around to everything. So what you do is you buy something really well, you film it on YouTube, you restore it or get it better whilst filming it on YouTube, and then you sell it at the right point. Whilst filming it on YouTube.
Yeah.
And you probably made all the money and you got the YouTube revenue.
And with YouTube, you can pump up the demand in it as well. And
Tom,
you can
do you want to go into business?
Yeah. Don't go into business with me, trust me. The worst thing you do.
How do you pump up demand?
Just tell everyone they're the best thing since sliced bread.
Okay.
And as long as what you've bought actually isn't awful, then people will believe you.
The prices on sales always... I was chatting to someone about the Subaru. He had a P1. And I was saying, we have a P1 this weekend. There's been a couple for sale recently. Prices... are reactive to public sales prices. The problem, you know, when they were sold with dealers, and many of my friends are dealers, and they can't really get it out there what a car sold for, and it sold particularly well. They often don't want to shout how much they've sold it for. Hmm. Whereas when it's sold in the public arena, whether it be auctions or anything similar, it sets the benchmark.
Yep.
So we can all go online, a car can be listed at £300,000. That means nothing until it's sold.
Yeah.
Because we can all put whatever we like on it. When it sells and sets benchmark, that then has a trickle-down effect. So I said to him with the P1, I said, well, if that sells particularly well at £50,000-£60,000, said we can have a conversation about what the market's done for a P1.
Yeah.
So that's where, from the selling perspective, track auction results, because they're often a massive publicity tool in relation to sales prices of cars. Yeah, it's why it's so important to have that ability to put a sale price all online. Otherwise, we wouldn't have a clue, would we?
No. Yeah. Love it. Well done. Well, good luck with that. I hope you make some wonga. Potentially another way to make money is to tick the correct options when you buy a brand new car, and also then when you're looking for a secondhand car, what's got the best options. So what could be the best options?
I think at the moment
from outside. Let's go from the outside and then we'll look at sort of interior.
Moment, everything
options.
Seems to be about carbon fibre.
Oh, I love carbon fibre.
Some of the ridiculous prices for, especially on super hypercars.
Yeah.
They're like £600,000 for a carbon fibre front end.
I'd pay it.
What?
A lot of the time as well, it's already carbon. They just don't paint it. That's a churn. Yeah. I appreciate that from manufacturers.
Was it Porsche were charging £80,000? Porsche were charging £80,000. I think it was £80,000 or £60,000 for a specific shade of green on a 911. I was like, what's in the
paint? Was it like that flip paint?
Possibly. I was like, how much?
There's a few more man hours, but I'm not, or women hours, or person hours, sorry. But I don't think it's worth that.
No. But it's out there, and some people have obviously paid.
People are paying for it. So yeah,
the Brunei cars used to have all this strange thing. Of course, you wouldn't necessarily know what he'd done, but they would always have something completely off spec.
Hmm.
I want that Mercedes colour. Well, Porsche would normally say no.
Mm.
But because he was going to buy 15 of them, they said, well, go on then. We'll use that shade and we'll change the entire factory around for you.
Yeah.
But generally, it's got to be performance options, isn't it?
Well, I think you're absolutely right, the carbon fibre stuff. I mean, on Ferrari's options list, I've got here for the Portofino M, which was the car that replaced the California T and has recently been replaced by the Roma. But the Portofino M at new, the carbon fibre front spoiler was
$3,000.
Yeah.
Well, seems cheap.
A Ferrari historical colour.
Oh, just to paint it in a historical.
Paint it in a historical Ferrari colour.
$3,000?
Can't be much more, surely.
Seven,
good. Yeah. Perfect.
And a dynamic forged diamond wheel.
What's dynamic about it?
Maybe the way that the artist
maybe
kind
the,
of like
the
did
bloke
it.
That did it was dynamic.
Yeah.
Just it's Dave over there. Dave's dynamic.
Dynamic Dave. That's
that
why
wheel.
His name is. How much?
12.
Oh.
$4,000?
Yeah, five.
Yeah, bargain, a snip.
Yeah, exactly. Interior stuff now. Let's look about interior. Okay. What do you go for on the options inside?
I think in Ferrari specifically, I think they're almost unsaleable, modern Ferraris, if they don't have the driving zone with the lights. If you don't have the shift lights particularly the carbon driving zone, then apparently it's game over. They just sit around forever. Apparently.
Okay, so do you go, when you were speccing a car, do you instantly think of resale?
I do. I think it's pretty mindless if you don't. If you buy something and willfully know that you'll never be able to sell it if you have to, just by being stubborn, then I think that's pretty mindless. But no, I would always, like, if there's a panoramic roof option or, you know, the driving zone, often as well, it will impact the residuals on the finance. So if you don't have the right options on the car, it'll be valued down. And actually your funding will be more expensive because they'll know that the cap value is worse.
When I bought this McCann, it was like, if you don't have Air suspension, that downgrades the value, because obviously Porsche would downgrade the value, the panoramic, everyone wants a pano roof now, even though I'm sure in 10 years' time they'll all leak and be absolutely disastrous. Yep. Everyone wants a pano roof and loud exhausts. But I think that even reflects further and further back. So, for instance, I mean, like a Jaguar E-Type, we used to have a Webasto roof. Well, everyone bagged it, didn't want a Webasto roof.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's a great idea. Mm. Why would you not want a coupe that you can throw the roof back in the summer?
Yeah.
But it was always typically worth less money.
There's one thing to note on the options, though. If you are leasing the car, you will just pay for the full price of the options over the course of the lease. So over 2-3 years, they'll just split up the amount the options cost, and it'll just be dumped onto the price of your lease. And there's actually no real point doing that if you're just giving the car back. But if you've bought the car, then it's worth looking at the options. It's worth actually seeing the different options.
I see.
Yeah. But so if you're leasing, it's like just
makes no difference.
Crazy money.
Yeah. You don't need to, if you don't want a panel roof, don't have a panel roof for leasing. There's
no, if you're just handing the car back, unless you're absolutely obsessed with seeing a grey sky in the UK through above your head. But if you're buying it, then often just check it out, because sometimes more expensive car actually finances better.
So traditionally, interior though, I would say things like sports seats tend to sort of hold value when it comes to getting older and older. So we're talking sort of 70s, 80s cars now. There's a C43 Mercedes here, which was optioned with the rear, I'd call it almost like independent seats. They're almost two bucket seats in the rear rather than the normal bench.
Nice.
And that, to me now, I'm looking at it, rare is that? And we're talking about one. There's probably only a smattering of cars that were spec'd like that. Would have been really expensive. Leather, obviously, was always a touch... for anything. I'm not really sure why it wears longer, but obviously any car with leather in the 80s and 70s has always seemed to be worth more money.
What about vegan options today? Would they be
I don't think they'll last.
Okay.
I'm not sure how durable it is.
I think that's going to be like the old Tex sort of style Mercedes leather, which is not seen as anything desirable.
As much as I want to champion it, I actually don't know. I don't know what it's going to do long term, and value-wise or durability-wise.
I mean, modern. I think it's sort of changed as well. So obviously, with more modern cars, everyone wants modern toys, don't they? Now. With older cars, it was more about the aesthetics and how it felt. So
felt
it was the look.
And ironically, the gearbox thing as well. The automatic option would be more expensive, but now they're now worth a lot less money. So your Tiptronic 993s are worth.
Yeah.
Nothing compared to the manual ones, but the manual was a free option. But the auto box was seen as like the new whizzy thing to have. But if you'd optioned that, then you would have stuffed yourself.
So what about colours? So let's talk classics. So if you had a Jaguar E-Type, what would be the colour not to go for on the interior?
Not to go for on the interior, a blue. Oh no. I don't know.
I think a blue is a good shout.
Blue might be a good shout. Dark blue.
Blue is a good shout.
Red's okay. Black's okay.
Red works
Cream?
Really well.
Cream.
Cream never wears well, does it? Unless you wear chinos your entire life.
I think grey's a bit... grey leather's awful.
Seen it work on only a couple of... If you've got a good blue coachwork with a grey, can work. Again, it matches with the
don't
exterior.
Don't know how popular, though.
But the most popular one recently was the grey with red, wasn't it? Blood red with grey paint. And quite like a biscuit. Looks quite nice. But again, that can make a big difference. You get the wrong colour spec on a car.
Yeah.
And it just doesn't work.
Yeah.
It just...
Rare.
Interestingly, I was at a dealership recently, and they've got 997 4 litres in there. If you want a black or a white one, they're sort of 400k. If you want a PTS car, they're over £1 million.
PTS?
Paint to sample. So there's a Riviera blue or a Mexico blue 4 litre that's over £1 million. Someone's actually paid over £1 million for it. There's a grey one for £1 million, but a black and white one's 400 grand.
Could you not... Would a wrap not be cheaper? Just wrap it in
it's not
colours,
it's not original, is it?
No, I know.
If you can afford it, that's the problem,
isn't
it?
Well, you know what? Yeah, exactly.
What's another £500,000?
Yeah.
Change.
I have got here my original options list that I ordered my Cayman GT4.
Oh, cool.
I know. So I want you to...
Porsche option list is always fun.
So I went in to buy my Cayman GT4... thinking, oh, Porsche spent millions on it. I don't need to tick any options list. And then I sat down and the bloke's like, well, when you need to sell it, you will need this, that, and the other. So can you tell me if I was an utter chump or a champion in
always these a champion, Vicky, always.
In these particular ones. So I went for full bucket seats, which were from the 918 Porsche.
So I'm assuming that would have done well.
Yeah.
So did I...
Fairly unsaleable without them.
Yeah. £1,900 I paid for those extras.
Not bad, actually.
I think so, too.
Because you could rip those seats out and flog them for serious cash. No, and obviously replace them. You can put the comfort seats in that would cost you about 1,500 quid, £2,000, but you can sell those seats for like $8,000.
Yeah.
So if you wanted to.
Oh, and do an
grand. I'd be taking the seats out tomorrow.
You could do a little equity release. And
the car has gone, by the way, now.
Yeah, seats back.
I went for the black leather interior with yellow stitching, 1,300 quid.
The yellow stitching, I think, would be here, not there. But the black, I mean, I think that's probably safe.
People like that extended leather stuff, don't they?
Yeah.
Because otherwise it comes with that plastic dash and stuff.
Yeah.
So, that's...
Probably nice, wouldn't... How much was it?
1,300.
It's not that...
I don't think you've been sold up the river yet.
No. Okay. Again, when it comes to braking, I think, you know, a car is not going to be sold with a high-performance engine with shoddy brakes, okay?
No,
so I was thinking... And then I was like, well, I'll get in there. Oh, yeah, I'm going to go for the ceramic composite brakes. Yeah, I'll take that at $5,000.
Oh. See, as much as they are great if you're using them heavy, the problem then is you start to lean towards the fact of, oh, what's this car being used for? So you do start to think, well, hang on a minute, it's done a bit of track work if it's been specced up to be pretty hefty on the brakes, because the standard brakes would obviously have been completely capable.
One would think. But don't forget, it was one careful lady owner when I sold
it. Yeah, seen that before, haven't we?
A lot of people that are doing a lot of track stuff, though, because the ceramics are so expensive to replace, a lot of people actually get the steel. Yeah. So the ones that get smashed about and battered on track days, they actually spec steels because you can borderline destroy them. And you can get new rotors, and they're really, really cheap. Whereas if you screw up, if you get a stone caught on your ceramic rotor, it's $10,000 for a new rotor. It can get really, really punchy. Mm. And a lot of people spec ceramics just because, A, it's a flex, and people are like, all right, have you got ceramics?
Yeah.
B, because they like yellow calipers. And C, because you don't get brake dust.
So was it a champ or chump then for getting my $5,000 ceramic?
$5,000's good. I think they're now like $7,000 or $8,000. So I don't think that's bad.
Are they not a little bit annoying to use on a daily basis?
Well, I didn't really use on a daily basis because I've got,
Porsche ones
dogs,
okay,
two
I think.
Kids.
Yeah. They don't, they need time to warm up, but I think in the Lambos and stuff they don't work to begin with, but I think the Porsche ones are actually...
Yeah. So I think, they're punchy, to buy, but would they put £5,000 on the car when you come to sell it? Probably £2,000-£3,000.
I think at some point, I think it would be the difference between it selling and almost straight away and not
saleable.
Two cars side by side, one's got ceramic, one hasn't.
So it's more saleable. Yeah. The value, but more saleable.
Okay, last couple here. Audio sat nav package, £2,000.
Because it's all rubbish. Within a year, everything is rubbish on cars. This is the problem now with that, because now it's Apple CarPlay or what have you. Next year it'll be something. And what happens is, the moment, if you get in an older car now and it would have had PCs. You put your phone there and it does twice as much.
Yeah, so and also cars get over the airway updates now.
So from a point of view of value when you sell it, pointless. From a point of view of using it, because at the time, it made it far more usable.
Yeah.
But generally speaking, all that audio stuff, technology moves too fast, way faster than cars.
Yeah.
So you will always typically find it's useless when it comes to selling it and someone's already thinking about
the next
thing. And unfortunately, the phone now has become almost as good as any stereo and sat-nav can ever be. You almost get to a point of thinking, is there any point? Can I just make a cradle in the middle of your dash and stick that in there?
Yep.
It's true. Yep. I think CarPlay is kind of the real benchmark. I think it's around for a little while. Yeah. So if
you've never used Apple CarPlay, it's available on iPhones and Android as well. It connects by Bluetooth or wireless or a wire, and it just mimics what's on your phone.
I think it's wonderful.
Yeah. It is fantastic.
It means you've got a screen, but your hard drive is in your pocket or in so you take it with you. So it just screens everything you need to do. Much better for maps as well, because you can use Waze, Google, whatever you want. Yeah. Whereas we all know, like the Porsche, the Mercedes, that you do your sat nav, and then they want to charge you in 3 years' time to update the maps, and they're always outdated compared to the other ones. So it all
in-house sat nav is terrible. Waze is great because it's all just updated by satellites and other people's phones. And actually, what I've never understood, I'm getting completely off topic, is the CarPlay mirrors your phone on the screen of the car. You're allowed to drive around willy-nilly, basically fiddling,
WhatsApping people.
WhatsApping.
But you can speak though, can't you?
Yeah,
hey Siri.
You're not typing, but that's even more distracting, arguably, because you're unfamiliar with the user interface. I just don't understand it's great that it does, but I just don't understand why you can still use your phone.
Just
basically
going slightly off topic on that. This is what drives me mad on a Porsche. So everything's touchscreen, right? where you can't just touch a screen and know where the button is. When you've got used to buttons, right, you
can
walk, look at the road, you know where your button is, you press it.
Yep.
Now you have to do this and you miss it and you miss it and you miss it and you've crashed. Yep. Touch screens are not clever. They are annoying on a car. You want buttons on steering wheels, heads-up displays, and you don't want to have to try and find what to touch on the screen.
Well, there's a big hoo-ha with the new Range Rover because on that central console now, they've removed all the buttons, even within the same, the latest generation. Within that generation, for some reason, maybe they've run out of buttons or something. Even the
world shortage.
Even the drive selector, everything, it's all gone. Oh,
so
it's just
annoying.
A smooth...
I mean, the only thing that saves you is now you've got that like distance control sat nav. You have to program that in so you don't crash into people while you look down to figure out how to turn your heated seats on. It's ridiculous. We've got one bit of technology to fix a piece of technology that didn't need freaking replacing.
Buttons, buttons, buttons.
Anyways, I've completely digressed there.
Let's move on quickly.
Absolutely.
So how much was your audio sat nav package?
Audio sat nav package, £2,000.
Yeah, see,
£2,000. And then I had to get the digital radio, I think, for £300. I mean, what's going on?
I think that's madness. You have to have that now because obviously other radios don't really work.
So,
I know. Anyway.
It does feel like you should come with a DAB radio.
Exactly.
I don't think you got ripped off there. If you'd spec privacy glass, though, we might have had quite a terse conversation on that.
Yes. Yeah, never spec privacy glass. If you need
on a sports car.
No, it's just
not a thing.
It doesn't look great.
No, well, it wasn't on my radar, so that's fine.
Good. You're not a
privacy
glass
person. However, what is on my radar? Las Vegas, baby. Oh. So, Las Vegas Formula One, it appeared over there for the first time ever. And who went?
Tell
us all about it.
It was
at this point you can all hurl abuse at Tom for getting the ability.
They'll
to
be hurling it already.
He wouldn't have paid. He would have been given lots of free stuff. Hurl abuse at this man.
It's disgusting. Yep. But someone's got to do it.
Was it really good?
To be honest with you, yeah, it was really good. Hey. Genuinely. I was concerned that it was obviously the first time. I think they have done F1 in Vegas like decades ago. But
in
it wasn't,
Caesar's Palace car park.
Yeah. It wasn't specific like track and everything that it was now. It was really good. I was really concerned that it was going to be terrible, but it was very well organised. I didn't queue for a single thing, and that's not just because I'm super celebrity, Insta idiot. No one was queuing. It was really well organised. There was just marshals absolutely everywhere, security absolutely everywhere. Everyone knew where they were going, and it was just the walk from the hotels.
Yeah. Can I ask a question?
There's no taxis, nothing. You didn't need them.
Obviously, other than for dramatic effect,
do
you think it needed to be along the strip? Or do you think it would have been better off not, so that they can keep everything open and people could still do the Vegas thing at the same time as being there for the Formula
I think the strip was really, really... Seeing the Formula One cars going down that strip with the Eiffel Tower and all that stuff, I think it was worth it for that alone. And
because they got that for 10 years, and the big problem that they're saying they're having is, of course, because they literally have to shut down. When you shut down Monaco, of course, it's not a problem, because everyone just basically hides in Monaco anyways. No one's ever out.
Or jumps
in. So it makes no difference. But in Vegas, of course, they then can't sell the rest of Vegas for that week. So they're assuming that Formula One can take up the entire town, which they can't. And that's the worry, the quandary they have going is we shut down the whole of the strip, we cover everything up, make sure it's completely unusable unless you're at Formula One.
Yeah.
But they do, that's one of the reasons why the race is so late, is so that during the daytime,
buses and cars can still use
the strip.
You see, they board off everything, they stop all the viewpoints because they don't want people being there without paying for their tickets.
Also, as well, they don't want people congregating because it gets really unsafe. So if people are all bunching up on all the walkways and stuff because they're watching the race, then there can be like crushing and sort of weight restrictions and stuff. So I think it's part that they do want people paying for tickets, but also just from a safety thing, they don't want people just peering through the barriers and they're causing chaos.
It's funny, this is the other street race circuits tend to be around marinas and things where it's quieter. Singapore is a bit citywide, but again, there it's a funny road system there anyways. But I looked and I thought, that's wonderful. It is wonderful to see them firing down the strip. But for the most part, the camera-wise, and you see it on TV, so you see a bit more, I suppose, just look like a chainmail prison to a point.
Yeah.
And then once in a while, they'll go up in the helicopters, and it looks amazing.
I think the camera work, you can tell it was a new race because there was a few shots of the sort of blank track. And even Lando's crash, you didn't actually catch what happened, what set him off. You got him crashing, but you didn't actually see the moment at which it caused it all. But on the whole, I thought it was amazing. And all the kind of cringe, cheesy nonsense.
Lap it up, baby.
I mean, you're obviously a fan, but...
I have to ask about the sort of what was the feeling when the crowds were asked to leave on the practice sessions?
I wasn't actually there. Because there was a few hour period where, and the rumours on the sort of the pit wall and everything, everyone was saying it was not going to reopen. So I actually disappeared. I scuttled off back to my hotel. It was only free practice anyway, so I thought might as well try and catch up on some sleep. So I wasn't actually there when there was that whole furore. I'm not sure how many people were actually that bothered by it. And I totally understand why that decision was made, because you can't have staff there for 24 hours, like in the paddock club and everything. There's thousands of staff. They're going to have to go home at some point, and someone's going to make a call whether to send them home or keep them hanging around. So, and if people are only employed to a certain time, then, you know, you can't have tens of thousands of people on site if the staff have gone. It's a safety thing. So
I mean, it's a 10-year project. I mean, it's an unusual, and they would, someone said, oh, why didn't they check? They would have checked it. It's just that the pull from those Formula One cars would have snapped the weld.
Of course.
And it popped it up. It could have happened at Singapore. It could have happened
absolutely.
At Montreal. It could have happened anywhere.
Yeah.
Just unfortunate for them. It happened on the very first section. But fortunate, it happened then and not in qualifying or the race. So.
Yeah. And unfortunately, no one was hurt. I think Carlos was a little bit, hurt by it, but not sort of
also
seriously.
A bit put out about the fact that you got a penalty for it. I thought it was a bit mean, wasn't it? But so well worth booking up for next year.
I would, yeah. And I think this year I spoke to a few people that had booked their accommodation super early. And then as it got towards the race, all the prices came down because they overpriced it. It wasn't as popular as they thought it would be. And they thought they could get away with charging thousands.
And it was through the it was
and it,
through
it
the
dropped earth. Last minute, though. Yeah. The combination, I think flights didn't necessarily... But the accommodation, but
there's a trick of
the
that's
floor.
Always been a trick of Vegas, regardless. Unless it's fully booked out for huge conferences, you can fly into Vegas and you can basically tune into the local radio stations, and then all the locals get given discount codes to go to the hotels that are the quiet. So you can go there for very little, because you try and fill every hotel in Vegas every single weekend. There's got to be a big fight on or a massive, massive conference on. Otherwise, there's always going to be.
The Venetian, where I was staying with Alpine, 7,108 rooms. Yeah. And up until recently, it was the most rooms in any hotel in the world. And that's just one hotel, 7,000 rooms.
And as we said, that weekend, they'd almost sort of shut down the rest of it. You could still go to Vegas, but you wouldn't go there to go and see the sights.
It was so quiet. When we first landed, apparently all the locals had disappeared. Anyone that was kind of would ordinarily have been scuttling
so
around
a bit
there.
Like Monaco,
then. They all got out of there because they've been having like construction work for months and months and months in advance. But they did it quite cleverly. There was new sort of flyovers and stuff. It was really well done.
They'll get much better. I mean, they will get much better, won't they?
Well, which leads us on to the last thing of our pod, which is I've got another little writing challenge for you, boys.
No.
Well, drawing, should I say.
Pencil
I've
cases
got,
here.
Got special pencil each. It's special because it will help you with your grip. They're my kids' pencils.
So someone's had a go. A chew on
I did wonder when I saw yours earlier, thinking, what are you chewing your pencil?
That's my dog, probably. So I'm going to rip a piece off for you. You need to draw a Formula One car with Elvis Presley at the wheel, but there's an extra twist, a super extra twist, which is you have to wear a mask. So this is your mask I'm going to ask you to
and
put on.
I'm not
on.
Allowed to see what you've got on the front.
Exactly. So you could just pop yours on.
So put the headphones down for a minute.
Yeah, I think so. And if you could put yours on, that would be really lovely. I can see the enthusiasm.
Vicky, are these like your go-to-sleep ones?
They're brand new, by the way.
Oh, okay.
They are brand new. They've not been used before.
So I've got to do a Formula One car with Elvis.
Formula One car with Elvis. And you've got
dignity.
And you've got...
We're going to speed this up, aren't we? Am I starting, yeah?
You got 30 seconds.
Oh, blimey. When now?
Ready, steady, go.
I really want to cheat.
Well, you've got some wheels there, so that's good work.
Okay.
Is this going well for you, chaps? Because I'm thoroughly enjoying myself.
I've lost my card.
Am I drawing on the table now?
No, you're doing good. You're doing good. You've got about another 5 seconds left. Four, three.
I've lost my Elvis. I don't know why. I shouldn't have taken my pencil.
One. There we go. Great.
I should not have taken the pencil off.
So. This is actually pretty good. I love... Oh, Elvis has got two S's. So Tom spelt it in
I'm a YouTuber for a reason. Leave me alone.
Tom. And that's that. I think that's really good, actually, boys. That is much better than I was expecting. Much better.
perfect. That's why didn't you? Why know. Do I love you?
You're,
you don't love
you're
me.
You're not getting love back.
What? Okay, fine. Feel victimized.
No, I love you. Feel victimized, and we love you, Tom.
Thank you.
Do.
I'm happy.
I love
with that.
That. Yeah, I think.
I think we did blooming well.
It's really
blindfolded.
Good.
I might actually have to give it to Tom.
I was trying to do collars, and it just didn't work at all.
Oh, you got the quiz.
What I did was I took my. As soon as I took my, I went like that, finished, I went, oh no, I don't know where is it? So then I managed to draw that.
Love it.
Completely blindfolded. Look how close that is.
That's very good. Well
look
done.
Love
it.
I would have failed charades though with writing.
Oh dear.
Oh, I can't wait for the next one. Woo! Right, that is it for this edition of the Historics Podcast. We would love to see you at some of next year's auctions. That's 2024. Oh yeah. The next one is on the 2nd of March.
It is, yes. Early
Ascot. Yes, so that would be that. In the meantime, can people talk to you, have a
of
value
course.
Of their car? What can
so
they do?
So if you have missed this auction, of course you would have done by now, but you're looking towards 2024 and selling your classic car, please do get in contact. You can click below or you can go to our website. You can email us, call us, any means possible. We'll then get back to you and we'll give you a no obligation valuation on your car. Come and see you if you wish and we can see if we can get your car into one of our auctions next year.
And Tom, finally from you, Insta, YouTube and Twitter handles, what have we got?
Absolutely, we've got all of the above. So if you're on Instagram, make sure you're following Historics on Instagram because you'll see a sneak peek of all the cars coming ahead of the next auction. And actually, that said, March next year for the next auction, I think that's a really good time to sell. So over the winter, if you're thinking about coming out of your car, make sure you get a valuation in because I think March, with interest rates dropping and sort of the summer coming in, I think it's going to be a really good time to sell. So that is off topic. Sorry about that.
No,
but make sure
it.
You're also subscribed on YouTube. If you're watching this on YouTube, then you already know about it, but hit the subscribe button so you don't miss any updates. And of course, wherever you follow your usual podcasts and usual streaming platforms, we are available on there. There is no missing us, basically. You can't avoid
stuff.
Us. Sorry about that.
Oh, thank you very much, chaps, for being with us, and thank you for joining us this time.
Thank you.
Bye for now.
Bye.